dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The U.S. maintains a vast global military empire with bases in more than 120 countries. This empire is maintained in conjunction with a few very large private corporations whose income comes almost exclusively from military contracts. This state of affairs has wide-reaching impact on our domestic policies and arrangements that are seldom examined or even acknowledged. The collective deep pocket that pays the bill for this military-industrial complex, as former President Dwight Eisenhower termed it, is the average American taxpayer, and she has little idea of what is being spent or how it's being used. The military and its bottom line seem to be above criticism. Both political parties in Congress fall over themselves to fling the taxpayers' money at what is euphemistically called defense. The Republicans and the increasingly look-alike Democrats decry big government while they shovel the national treasure into the maw of the military machine. There is never a shortage of funds to control people at home with police and prisons, or to dominate the rest of the world's people with the largest military in the history of the world. But, we are told, Social Security is too expensive, and free medical care, free education for all through college, cleaning up our polluted lands or converting the country to renewable energy is unaffordable. Tonight, our main presentation will be an in-depth look at the dollar costs of the U.S. military machine. But first, a couple of things directed at the question of why we, in an ostensible democracy, allow the government to throw our money at a bloated military while it denies us the things that would make our lives easier. The following article, from an unexpected writer, was published in the August 17th edition of the London Observer. It's titled Lessons in How to Lie About Iraq, and the author is musician Brian Eno. He wrote, "When I first visited Russia in 1986, I made friends with a musician whose father had been Brezhnev's personal doctor. One day we were talking about life during the, quote, period of stagnation, the Brezhnev era. It must have been strange being so completely immersed in propaganda, I said. Ah, but there is a difference. We knew it was propaganda, replied Sasha. That is the difference. Russian propaganda was so obvious that most Russians were able to ignore it. They took it for granted that the government operated in its own interests, and any message coming from it was probably slanted, and they discounted it. In the West, the calculated manipulation of public opinion to serve political and ideological interests is much more covert, and therefore much more effective. Its greatest triumph is that we generally don't notice it, or laugh at the notion that it even exists. We watch the democratic process taking place. Heated debates in which we feel we could have a voice, and think that, because we have a free media, it would be hard for the government to get away with anything very devious without someone calling them on it. It takes something as dramatic as the invasion of Iraq to make us look a bit more closely and ask, how did we get there? How exactly did it come about that, in a world of AIDS, global warming, 30-plus active wars, several famines, cloning, genetic engineering, and 2 billion people in poverty, practically the only thing we all talked about for a year was Iraq and Saddam Hussein? Was it really that big a problem? Or were we somehow manipulated into believing the Iraq issue was important and had to be fixed right now, even though a few months before, few had mentioned it, and nothing had changed in the interim? In the wake of the events of 11 September 2001, it now seems clear that the shock of the attacks was exploited in America. According to Sheldon Rampton and John Stauber in their new book, Weapons of Mass Deception, it was used to engineer a state of emergency that would justify an invasion of Iraq. Rampton and Stauber expose how news was fabricated and made to seem real, but they also demonstrate how a coalition of the willing, far-right officials, neocon think tanks, insanely pugilistic media commentators, and of course, well-paid PR companies worked together to pull off a sensational piece of intellectual dishonesty. Theirs is a study of modern propaganda. What occurs to me in reading their book is that the new American approach to social control is so much more sophisticated and pervasive that it really deserves a new name. It isn't just propaganda anymore, it's prop agenda. It's not so much the control of what we think, but the control of what we think about. When our governments want to sell us a course of action, they do it by making sure it's the only thing on the agenda, the only thing everyone's talking about. And they preload the ensuing discussion with highly selected images, devious and prejudicial language, dubious linkages, weak or false intelligence, and selected leaks. What else can the spat between the BBC and Alistair Campbell be but a prime example of this? With the ground thus prepared, governments are happy if you then use the democratic process to agree or disagree. For after all, their intention is to mobilize enough headlines and conversation to make the whole thing seem real and urgent. The more emotional the debate, the better. Emotion creates reality. Reality demands action. An example of this process is one highlighted by Rampton and Stauber, which, more than any other, consolidated public and congressional approval for the 1991 Gulf War. We recall the horrifying stories, incessantly repeated, of babies in Kuwaiti hospitals ripped out of their incubators and left to die while the Iraqis shipped the incubators back to Baghdad. 312 babies, we were told. The story was brought to public attention by Nayira, a 15-year-old, quote, nurse, who it turned out later was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador in the U.S. and a member of the Kuwaiti royal family. Nayira had been tutored and rehearsed by the Hill and Knowlton PR agency, which in turn received $14 million from the American government for their work in promoting the war. Her story was entirely discredited within weeks, but by then its purpose had been served. It had created an outraged and emotional mindset within America which overwhelmed rational discussion. As we are seeing now, the most recent Gulf War entailed many similar deceits. False linkages made between Saddam, Al-Qaeda, and 9/11, stories of ready-to-launch weapons that didn't exist, of nuclear programs never embarked upon. As Rampton and Stauber show, many of these allegations were discredited as they were being made, not least by this newspaper, that being the Observer Guardian, but nevertheless were retold. Throughout all this, the hired gun PR companies were busy preconditioning the emotional landscape. Their marketing talents were particularly useful in the large-scale manipulation of language that the campaign entailed. The Bushites realized, as do all ideologues, that words create realities, and that the right words can overwhelm any chance of balanced discussion. Guided by the overtly imperial vision of the Project for a New American Century, whose members now form the core of the American administration, The PR companies helped finesse the language to create an atmosphere of simmering panic, where American imperialism would come to seem not only acceptable, but right, obvious, inevitable, and even somehow kind. Aside from the incessant weapons of mass destruction, there were regime change, military invasion, preemptive defense, attacking a country that is not attacking you, critical regions, countries we want to control, and axis of evil, countries we want to attack, shock and awe, massive obliteration, and war on terror, a hold-all excuse for projecting American military force anywhere. Meanwhile, U.S. federal employees and military personnel were told to refer to the invasion as a war of liberation, and to Iraqi paramilitaries as death squads, while the reliably sycophantic American TV networks spoke of Operation Iraqi Freedom, just as the Pentagon asked them to, thus consolidating the supposition that Iraqi freedom was the point of the war. Anyone questioning the invasion was soft on terror, liberal, or, in the case of the UN, in danger of losing its relevance. When I was young, an eccentric uncle decided to teach me how to lie. Not, he explained, because he wanted me to lie, but because he thought I should know how it's done, so I would recognize when I was being lied to. I hope writers such as Rampton and Stauber and others may have the same effect, and help to emasculate the culture of spin and dissembling that is overtaking our political establishments. And that was an article, Lessons in How to Lie About Iraq, by Brian Eno, published in the August 17th edition of the London Observer. A longer version of the article will appear in the new literary magazine, Zembla. Still on the thread of popular pacification, next we present a speech by Christopher Pyle that was given at the Trap Rock Peace Center in Deerfield, Massachusetts, last July.
Professor Christopher Pyle has been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, 100 newspapers, more than 100 newspapers nationwide have carried his works, and that article that he wrote in 1970 won the Hillman Award and the Polk Award, very prestigious awards for investigative journalism. Please give a warm welcome to Professor Christopher Pyle of Mount Holyoke College.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. As you've heard, my acquaintance with these issues is not entirely academic. As Sonny told you, before I was a professor, is this not working?
It's for the recording devices.
I see.
So such a big crowd, we'll just have to project.
Excuse me, okay. As Sonny has told you, I was a professor. Before I was a professor, I taught at the U.S. Army Intelligence School. And in that capacity, learned of the Army's domestic spying on civilians. Most Americans have forgotten about that now. But back in the late 60s, the U.S. Army had over 1,500 plainclothes agents working out of some 300 offices, watching every demonstration of 20 people or more. It had massive data banks. It kept files on the lawful political activities of millions of Americans, including even a few members of Congress. And as Sonny has pointed out, I disclosed that surveillance in 1970 and then quietly went about recruiting 125 counterintelligence agents to tell what they knew about the surveillance to members of Congress, the courts, and the press. Many of these were former students of mine at the U.S. Army Intelligence School. It's kind of an alumni association. In the process, I became not only a whistleblower, but an investigative journalist, an organizer of litigation for the American Civil Liberties Union, and a consultant to three congressional committees, including Senator Sam Ervin's Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights and Senator Frank Church's Select Committee on Intelligence, which, as you know, did the major investigations of all of the domestic surveillance activities of the 60s and 70s. Well, to make a long story short, there were a lot of newspaper articles, congressional hearings, lawsuits, TV documentaries. And in the end, the U.S. Army was forced to end the surveillance, burn all its files, and even abolish the U.S. Army Intelligence Command. Although we had no clue at the time, those disclosures would later turn out to be the first of a series of scandals that led to what historians now label, rather generically, to be Watergate. Watergate being more than a third-rate burglary, but a name for massive surveillance of political dissent. Well, it's not my purpose to reminisce about those ancient matters now, but rather to say a few words about the new intelligence apparatus that has been created in response to the attacks of September 11, and to suggest how an investigation like mine would be more difficult to pull off today, precisely because of the scope of the new intelligence apparatus. See, I'm prepared to depress you. But perhaps by this method I can explain to you why I think this new apparatus is far more dangerous than anything we faced back in the era known as Watergate. The first thing you should know about the new apparatus is that it dwarfs anything that J. Edgar Hoover could possibly have imagined. Indeed, it dwarfs anything the Gestapo or the KGB could have imagined because of the magic of computer technology. I'm not suggesting that the spirit behind the new system is the spirit of the KGB or the Gestapo, or even J. Edgar Hoover. It's not, at least not at the moment. But it is massive, and it is so because what used to take J. Edgar Hoover's gumshoes weeks of door-knocking to collect can now be accessed in a nanosecond with a computer. Second, the number of government agencies with the capability to collect this kind of information on you and me has grown exponentially since September 11th. After the reforms of 1976, and before September 11th, 2001, there was just the FBI and the police, and most of what they focused on, not all of it, but most of it, was criminal activity. Today, there are dozens of agencies, U.S. and foreign, linked together by fiber optic cables for the purposes of sharing information and, of necessity, misinformation about suspected terrorists and people who might know them. Today, these agencies do not start with what we used to call the criminal predicate, some evidence of criminal activity. They start instead by tracking down every rumor and suspicion, including those triggered by a person's lawful political activities or religious associations. Now, since September 11, the military has returned to domestic surveillance in a big way, but not as in the old days with counterintelligence agents on the street in plain clothes, but now with what is known as data mining. Data mining is the name of the game, and every agency with a computer can play it. Your privacy and mine has never been in more danger. Sonny has referred to one example, the Total Information Awareness System being developed by former Admiral John Poindexter. You may remember Admiral Poindexter. He was Ronald Reagan's national security advisor. He was the one who sold American weapons to a terrorist nation in order to pick up some profits to support a covert military operation in Nicaragua. Well, despite his criminal record and his convictions, he has been hired by the Pentagon to develop a system of bringing together the results of governmental and commercial data banks to create profiles of suspects and people who might know suspects and people who might know people who are suspects. And we're all about 6 degrees of removal from other people anyway, so you and I can be on that list. The idea is to produce detailed profiles of suspected terrorists, but the capability, once established, can be used whenever the government is concerned about and wishes to silence its critics. And that is the great danger. And that's what I'd like to focus on this afternoon, and ask you to imagine that, like me, you happen to stumble across evidence of serious abuses of this new investigative and surveillance power. Perhaps it's a new enemies list, like Richard Nixon had. Or perhaps a system of oppositional research, like the Watergate burglary of the Democratic Party's headquarters. Or perhaps it's just an effort to defame a critic like Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers, and whom the government attempted to defame by burglarizing the files of Ellsberg's psychiatrist. Imagine that you're a whistleblower, or a journalist, or a congressional staffer, or an attorney working with the ACLU, which were all roles that I played in ancient times. You want to investigate and expose the wrongdoing. What are your chances of success today? Before the system cracks down on you. I would say not very good. I would not wish in any way to deter you from doing that, but I'm just saying it's harder now. My first article in the Washington Monthly prompted over 50 congressional inquiries of the Pentagon. And in response, the Pentagon, as bureaucracies always do, set up a damage control unit, a 50-man damage control unit in the basement of the Pentagon that operated for about 2 years in secret. And its purpose was to investigate and discredit every critical disclosure of the Army's domestic intelligence operations. This 50-man unit was connected to the 1,500 agents out in the field. So as soon as I leaked something to the press, they could go at it and see if they could disprove it. This is what you would probably face. Let's be realistic. This is the way bureaucracies work. They want to protect themselves. They do this. Now, even in those days, it took the Army 4 months to figure out that I was essentially running a counterintelligence operation against them, talking to their agents and former agents, going around the country. Once they figured that out, and that I was behind the leaks to the press, they then had me investigated. General Yarborough, who was the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, was convinced that somehow I was getting my money from the Chi-Coms, Chinese Communists. I was actually living on the GI Bill. They were paying me to do to them what they would do to me. Today, a General Yarborough, his counterpart, would accuse you of working for Al-Qaeda, right? They would just assume that. Or if they're like Ann Coulter, they would assume that because you vote Democratic, that obviously you're guilty of treason. Well, the Army did ask my mailman to monitor my mail, which is pretty silly, actually. I'd been trained as an intelligence officer, and I knew well enough to set up mail drops at my friends' apartments. And we always mailed things in double envelopes with lots of tape and washable ink so that if anybody opened them, we would at least know it. You could still do the same. That simple technology would work for you. But you'd probably hear from some of your sources, at least initially, by email. And under the new Patriot Act, the government can quickly gain access to your email, perhaps through John Poindexter's operation at the Pentagon. That means you have lost security. That means your relations to your confidential sources are in danger. You might also communicate with them by telephone. Now, back in 1970, I did that with the confidence that I was unlikely to be wiretapped too often because it was difficult. You had to climb a telephone pole or sit in a basement full of roaches with their earphones listening to a wiretap. That limited the scale of the government's surveillance. Today, however, wiretaps are installed by the phone company at a central switching office and are then sent down a dedicated line to a computer run by the government that searches for keywords and then records the key passages and leaves out the other stuff. Now, back in 1970, wiretapping was limited by law. Or at least we thought so. We thought the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, which guarantees us freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, had some potency. Or at least the 1968 Wiretap Act had some potency. No longer. Under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, as amended by the Patriot Act, government agents can easily get what I call a pseudo-warrant to tap your phone or bug your home. And they get it not from a regular court. They might have some curiosity, at least some of them. But from a secret foreign intelligence surveillance court whose members are appointed by William H. Rehnquist. And they can get these warrants to tap your phones without having to show, as the Fourth Amendment requires, that there is probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed and that the evidence of that crime is likely to be found on the wire to be tapped or the home to be bugged. Indeed, the agents would not have to target you at all. They wouldn't have to go into court and say, I want to put a wiretap on this journalist or this lawyer, this investigator. No. What they would do is go into court and say, we have a suspected terrorist. We want to tap his phone. And we want authority also to tap any phone he might use. So if you have a terrorist living in your apartment building, all the phones in your building might be used because the terrorist, like me, would use the phones in his friend's apartments, right? He wouldn't use his own. That means that if the government wants to tap a journalist, it has a technique of doing it that it could use without having to tell a judge it planned to tap a journalist or a congressional staffer or an attorney. That's serious. Now, back in 1970, when the government conducted a wiretap, it had to have a return of the warrant, go back, and show the judge what it had collected. Not so with the FISA court. And besides, they collect so much now, and they have so many wiretaps, that it would be impossible for the FISA court to go through all the transcripts, let alone question what uses were made of various information. Now, your best bet, of course, would be to get a wireless cell phone and buy a new one every week, because that's about the only way you can get around that system. Still, it's possible for you. I don't want to discourage you, but you have to adapt. Now, back in 1970, if I wanted to go see a confidential source, I could get in my little blue Volkswagen and travel with fair confidence the government wasn't going to know. Because if they put a chase car on me, I was likely to know. Because I used to teach people how to run chase cars. Okay? Today, they wouldn't bother to send a chase car. They just would check your credit card billings, and where you bought your gasoline, and your easy pass on the toll booths, and they'd pretty well know which cities you went to. And they'll maybe pick you up at the other end. Again, you can get around this. You can take the back roads. But it's more expensive. It's more difficult. It's more time consuming. Now, back in 1970, I was concerned that the government might burglarize my apartment in search of documents or the identity of my sources. I had a source inside the 50-man unit. We codenamed him Yellow Pants, because the day I first met him, he was wearing those bell-bottom, mustard-colored corduroy pants that were popular in 1970. And I was very much concerned with protecting Yellow Pants' identity, because he could always tell me what the Army was going to reply to Senator Ervin a day and a half before Senator Ervin got the reply, so I could then brief Senator Ervin. Well, it was reasonable to worry about burglaries back then, because we later discovered, when I worked for the Church Committee, that the government had conducted hundreds of burglaries. They called them black bag jobs. Today, the government would not have to conduct an illegal burglary, because under the Patriot Act, it can conduct what are called sneak and peek searches under those pseudo-warrants issued by the Secret Court. And the government doesn't have to leave a copy of the warrant behind or an inventory of the things taken. So when you get home and find your laptop is missing, you have no idea who came in and stole your laptop. And the only way you would find out about it is if the government were to use evidence from your laptop in a prosecution, which it is unlikely to be foolish enough to do. That will be used for leads, and they may even, as Hoover did, camouflage the source by saying it was an informant when really it was a burglary. Okay. Now, back in 1970, I could be fairly confident that if my confidential sources were identified, they would not be secretly arrested and made to disappear. No longer. As you know, the Bush administration believes that the president's war power, and they claim we're in a war, that the president's war power enables him to make people disappear by the simple expedient of labeling them enemy combatants. Under the Patriot II Act, which the Bush administration is certain to submit to Congress when the next terrorist attack occurs, so it can stampede it through swiftly, the government would be authorized to arrest people in secret and not reveal that it even has them in detention in response to a Freedom of Information Act request which you might file as a family member or reporter or attorney. But we really don't have to wait for the Patriot II Act to be enacted. The Bush administration has already detained over 1,200 people without criminal charges, on the pretext that they have violated the immigration laws, and maybe they have, but really for the purpose of interrogating them about possible connections with terrorists, even though it knows it has no information of any such connection. In other words, these are arrests for interrogation purposes only, something we thought couldn't happen under the Fourth Amendment. We used to think that the Fourth Amendment had some clout. No longer. What we really need is a requiem mass for the Fourth Amendment. You do not have a constitutional right of privacy under this system. Now, many of those 1,200 detainees were seized peremptorily, locked up as if they were murderers or terrorists, chained feet and hands with a chain between the two, forced to sleep in cells that were lit all the time, kept in their cells 23 hours a day, and held for 80 to 90 days on average. When their wives went to the prison in Brooklyn to ask if their husbands were inside, the receptionist said no. Somebody had forgotten to give her the list of the detainees in the back ward. Now, back in 1970, some people wanted me prosecuted for espionage or treason because I had given information about the intelligence agencies to members of Congress, the press, and the courts. If that had happened, however, I would have had the reasonable expectation that I would be prosecuted in a federal civilian court with the usual protections of the Constitution and maybe even some high-priced lawyers. Today, you can't be so sure. The administration claims we are at war, and that anyone suspected of working for or somehow associated with Al-Qaeda is an enemy combatant. Now, as we know from the Padilla and Elmira cases, you don't have to have fought in combat or even been a member of a combat unit in order to be called an enemy combatant. The label is all that suffices. Once the label is attached to you by John Ashcroft, you can be taken away from the jurisdiction of a federal court, locked up in a military brig in South Carolina, denied access to an attorney, denied access to your family, and held indefinitely. Worse, the Bush administration reserves the power, that it asserts, since it's never been really affirmed, to take you out of that brig someday and prosecute you before a special military tribunal. A tribunal that has been rigged to not follow the standard rules of evidence in either military or civilian courts. And then even to execute you on a two-thirds vote of the military judges. No reasonable doubt. When one-third of the panel thinks you're innocent, that's not a reasonable doubt. If two-thirds think it's reasonable to kill you. Well, let's suppose you don't get arrested. That's a dire example, remote maybe. Only your sources are seized and spirited away in the night. The Bush administration won't tell you where they are. The federal prison system won't tell you where they are. So you go to a congressional committee, and it makes the inquiry. Is it likely to be successful? They haven't been so far. But let's say you persist, and the government really is upset about what you're doing. It may claim that you're associated somehow with your sources, who may be associated with terrorists. If so, it can convene a grand jury, haul you before the grand jury, and demand that you disclose their identities. It'll give you immunity from prosecution for any self-incriminating statements, in return for you incriminating everybody else, and give you the choice, if you don't like that, of going to jail. At least for the duration of the grand jury. But under the Patriot Act, the government really does not have to bludgeon you with a grand jury proceeding. It can arrest you and hold you, as the Bush administration has, for over a month as an alleged material witness to somebody else's crimes. They don't have to charge you and lock you away because you're a witness and you might flee. And it will do it in a court system where the judges are likely to defer to the government, as was the case in the Fourth U.S. Circuit. Or the government can obtain a court order requiring you to produce any tangible thing, which could include your spiral-bound notebook as a reporter, or perhaps your TV film as a TV producer, if its purpose is allegedly to facilitate some form of counter-terrorist investigation. Now, for your investigation to succeed, you will probably need a few voluntary whistleblowers like I was to give you the information that will expose the wrongdoing. Unfortunately, since 1970, the government has beefed up its system of non-disclosure pledges. When the government went searching for my non-disclosure statement in 1970, they couldn't find it. It had disappeared. And never have found it. But today, they require most people to sign a couple of them. When they come in, they sign two. When they go out, they sign a couple. And the government is even creating a new form of Homeland Security information that, while not classified information, will get you in trouble if you disclose it. Even if your purpose of disclosing it is to inform the Congress of the United States or the courts of the United States that illegal activity is going on. Now, in my case, I was able to recruit 125 agents. That was because they were all in and outers. They had either been drafted, or like me, they were volunteer officers, reservists. They no longer exist. Now we have essentially a professional army. We don't have many in and outers. And so we have people who are more likely to put their loyalty to the institution above their responsibility to the Constitution. So your ability to get these sources is going to diminish. But let's, for the fun of it, say you are successful. The government's inefficient, and you're invited to testify before Congress, as I was. That damage control unit down in the basement of the Pentagon is going to be very upset now. In my case, the Army put me down for a punitive tax audit and Nixon's enemies list. Army colonels went up to the Hill to tell congressional staffers, quite falsely, that I had fathered 4 illegitimate children. Now that's petty stuff, right? And nobody on the Hill believed it. And if they believed it, they regarded it as irrelevant. But today, imagine what they could do to your reputation with the power of computer hacking. And particularly if they can get into your psychiatric or medical records, not by burglarizing your doctor's office, but by going into the medical insurance company's files, which they can do. Well, I could go on, but you get the idea. Today, we have a domestic intelligence bureaucracy that can do a lot of harm to those who challenge its legitimacy or its usefulness. Our capacity to subject that system to oversight, either by Congress or the press or by litigation, is very weak. Our capacity to bring it to heel is weak as well, especially so long as both houses of Congress and the White House are controlled by the same political party. And that would be the case if the Democrats were in power. It wouldn't make a lot of difference. Now, I'd like to be able to say that we're in this predicament because bad people have taken over. But that's really inaccurate. The fact is, this is a very democratic system. The intelligence apparatus I've described is supported by an inattentive public and docile members of Congress who unwisely assume that this apparatus will only be used against those other people. It won't be used against us. And while we'll defend our own rights to the death, for convenience and safety's sake, we're more than willing to give up somebody else's rights, not seeing the connection. We need to correct that misperception. Thank you very much.
That was investigative journalist and former military intelligence whistleblower Christopher Pyle speaking last July in Massachusetts.
The party that became so powerful by sinking foreign bugs is dreaming up new promises, 'cause promises win votes. Being resolute in conference, the ad man's expertise, the majority by their silence should pay for days like these. The right to build communities is back behind closed doors. Between government and people stands the right arm of the law. And shame upon the patriot when the mark of the bulldog breed is a family without a home and a pensioner in need. Those whose lives are ruled by dogma are waiting for a sign. The better dead than Red Brigade are listening on the line. And a liberal with a small L cries in front of the TV. And another demonstration passes on to history. Thank you. Peace, bread, work and freedom is the best we can achieve. And wearing badges is not enough in days like these.
Billy Bragg, Days Like These. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio, Santa Cruz. Now for the conclusion of our program, The Economic Costs of War. This talk was delivered by Joe Farah earlier this month at the Veterans for Peace National Convention in San Francisco.
This paper I've got is 18 pages, single space. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you. It's got appendices and footnotes, but you might want to access it on the web after we access it, talk about it here. My background is essentially I'm an armchair academic, armchair military historian. I worked at a number of universities and think tanks, and for 12 years I taught a course. I did my master's thesis on the role of air power in the battles of Dien Bien Phu and Khe San. I was in the Army 1960 to 1963, and the Berlin Crisis was my big experience during the Pentatomic Army days, you know, where everybody was going to go into battle and they'd throw the nuclear weapons and it would be all over. Yes, my name is Joe Farah, F-A-R-A-H, and I'm the chapter president for Indianapolis, or Indiana, chapter number 49. I taught a course on the Vietnam War for 12 years. I've been to Vietnam twice as a researcher, so I've done a lot of writing and research on that country and our effort there. I was in Germany during the Berlin Crisis, and I've been back and forth several times since researching fascism, and I've written papers on that particular topic. I also ran a small think tank for the Democratic Leadership Council in Indianapolis called the Sycamore Institute that they launched during an election year and lost funding 2 years later. But it was an opportunity to see how grassroots politics was changing and how the parties are kind of fading away from the people and so on. And my interest in this topic has been over the last several years. Said to myself, I'm going to dig into the Department of Defense budget, and I'm not going to come out until I understand it. Well, I still haven't got out of the sand pit that I've gotten in, and I'll share that with you, but I've gotten into some areas where I think we could have some basic understanding where people say, oh, I see how they're doing that or how they're manipulating the numbers and so on. Okay, the economic costs of modern war. The only safe generalization one can make about the costs of war is that they are extremely unpredictable. This is by a guy named William D. Harding, who wrote a paper on the internet called The Hidden Costs of War, very interesting piece. And the Veterans for Peace Statement of Purpose says, increase public awareness of the total costs of war. One of the most difficult and complex problems in political science and economics is to try to calculate the cost of modern war. Precise expenditures for any war are nearly impossible to calculate because of all the variables and the long-term direct and indirect costs involved. Modern warfare in the 20th and now the 21st centuries has changed dramatically from warfare in previous historical eras in terms of its scope and lethality. Modern wars are much more deadly than those in the past due to advances in military science and technology, coupled with an unchecked worldwide proliferation of low-cost conventional weapons. So you've got the good science and the glut of weapons. That's what's making war so lethal today, one of the main reasons why. Despite its vast human and economic cost, war still remains the principal means by which significant international disputes are resolved. While the elimination of war as an instrument of policy among nation states has been a long-standing, universally expressed desire of humanity, a viable institutional framework for the elimination of war remains elusive in a world where the projection of national power through military force remains the dominant, legitimately recognized means for resolving international conflicts. Okay? We got the nation states, we got wars. The closest the world has come to formalizing an agreement toward the elimination of war as an instrument of policy was in 1928. Within a year, more than 50 nations, including all the major powers, had formally endorsed what became known as the Pact of Paris. You may not have heard of the Pact of Paris, but if you're going to talk about peace, you need to get this into your repertoire. The Pact of Paris, the treaty providing for the renunciation of war as an instrument of national policy, was signed in Paris on 27 August 1928 and entered into force on 24 July 1929. The depositary is the United States of America. That is, we hold the document. By 1934, the last year in which a nation joined until 1971, the Pact of Paris numbered as parties 62 of the then 75 sovereign nations of the world. That is an 83% rate figure, an extraordinarily high proportion. signing this pact, saying we're not going to have war as an instrument of policy. The Pact of Paris of 1928 to renounce war as an instrument of foreign policy was the first and to date only unambiguous formal worldwide attempt to achieve a world without war. The Pact of Paris of 1928 did not succeed in eliminating war. Far from it. What it did do, following some 8,000 or so years of social acceptability, was to finally make interstate war an illegal activity. The idea that war between nation states was now illegal in the international community for the first time, at least in its many parties. The authors of the pacts themselves hoped that it would provide the social and moral guidance to governments and peoples of the world, and in time, induce psychological change in how they viewed war. Well, it never happened, as we know. It is, of course, a tragedy that despite the Pact of 1928, preparation for war and war itself remain a major preoccupation of human society. Thus today, between 2 and 3% of the global labor force, that's 2 to 3% of the global labor force, among them between 20 and 25% of all natural scientists and engineers, continue to be accounted for by the military sector of human society. Roughly 20% of all revenues the nations of the world collect continue to be used for military purposes. Okay? That's the scope of things. While the desire to eliminate war has been embraced in the abstract by each succeeding generation of humanity, maintaining military power with its attending high economic cost has become and continues to be the major priority of the modern nation state, while at the same time a severe impediment to the development of the newer, lesser affluent third world nations that have risen from the ashes of colonialism. So we all know from our studies of third worlds how much military debt is crushing the economies and stifling the growth and health and everything else of these countries. We know that. It's obvious. It's been documented. But we don't seem to be able to penetrate that. A little bit of historical perspective. History provides the best starting point to see how the economic costs of war have escalated over time as civilization has evolved. One fundamental question that is never asked before, during, or sometimes even after a war is, how much does it cost in national treasure to kill every enemy soldier in battle? How much does it cost? We get all kinds of conflicting views on that. One seemingly easy way to answer this question would be to simply divide the final cost of a war, as estimated by the government, by the number of documented military casualties, period. But the question is much more complicated than that. One historian writing during the height of World War II estimated that it cost Caesar about 75 cents to kill a man in battle. That Napoleon almost bankrupted France because it cost a fraction under $3,000 to kill an enemy soldier in his day, early 19th century. This is World War I, ran the cost up to $21,000 per dead soldier, and it is estimated before the present conflict, this is talking about World War II, ends, it will have risen to $50,000 per soldier killed. That's what it costs in gross domestic product when you amortize everything out. And they don't even amortize everything out, as we'll see. Yes, those are what we call then-year dollars. Yeah, when I'll talk about then-year dollars and current dollars and how we make those kinds of conversions and how our Congress people and our Defense Department lie to us because they'll use the cheaper dollars from an earlier period with the current production cost and they'll use the lower production cost with the higher current dollar figures and they play a manipulation game that only a few can sort out and nobody can really see on the evening news, okay? What is this all about? And they blow it away. Okay. According to the data compiled by the Center for Defense Information from various U.S. government sources, World War II cost the United States $4.5 trillion in current 2001 dollars. World War II, if you costed it out today, it cost $4.5 trillion, about half of our gross domestic product today for 1 year. Everything we make and produce in America for 1 year is about $9 trillion. Half of that, cut half of that off, that's what World War II costs, okay? Which is really, World War II was really a series of 162 bilateral wars. You know, World War II is kind of an abstract concept. Oh, the whole world is at war? No, not really. It's 162 different declarations between nation states. The United States declares war against Germany, Germany against the United States, Japan against the United States, America against Italy. Thailand, which was called Siam, declares war on the United States, and it goes on and on. So that's what a world war is. It's a multiple bilateral war arrangement. The war ultimately resulted in approximately 60 million lives lost, both civilian and military. 60 million lives, World War II. Rough figure to have at your fingertip when you're talking into groups, okay? The United States suffered 407,316 military deaths, about a half a million, and 671,846 wounded, and 78,751 missing in action. So MIAs in World War II are greater than the total casualties killed in Vietnam War by 20,000. For a total casualty count of World War II of 1,079,162, our enemy, the Axis powers, suffered 5.4 million military deaths killed in action and another 8.1 million wounded. Pretty bloody. That does not count the civilian populations, which we'll talk about later. Here's an alarming trend that we as Veterans for Peace ought to become aware of. The increasingly high number of civilian casualties, primarily during the wars of the 20th century, represent an alarming trend that has gone virtually unnoticed. From the beginning of the 18th century up until 1987, okay, to the 20th century, there were 471 wars recorded. That is, conflicts with deaths over 1,000 people. That's how you classify a war. Deaths over 1,000 people, we have a war. Resulting in 101,550,000 deaths. 101 million, twice what World War II was. Okay? Throughout most of the history, as many civilians as professional soldiers have been killed in wars. From the 18th through the 20th century, civilians represented about 50% of war-related casualties. About half the people killed in wars up until the 20th century were soldiers and half were civilians. Okay? However, most of these wars during the past 300 years, approximately 90% of them have occurred in the 20th century. The percentage of civilians in death, in the death toll has been increasing. In the 1960s, civilians accounted for 52% of the deaths in war. By 1970s, that had increased to 73%. And by the 1980s, it was up to 85%. And currently, it's about 92%. Because of the weapons of mass destruction that are the conventional weapons we're talking about that are used so indiscriminately, the civilian populations are now targets. And we can go back and see this trend developing even at the end of World War II when some of the air power enthusiasts were advocating bunker-busting bombs and things back then and striking the heart of the enemy, destroying their industrial potential, and so on. Okay, calculating the real dollar cost of war. This is the complicated part, but I'll skim over it. If we calculate some of the historical cost estimates of war in today's real dollars, we can begin to understand how truly expensive modern warfare has become. And if we calculate the cost of modern war conducted in the post-World War II era up to today, the costs become almost incomprehensible. We're talking $500,000 per soldier killed. World War II provides a good example for this kind of inquiry. If in 1942, the estimated cost to kill an enemy soldier was around $50,000 in then-year dollars, in 1940s dollars, what would it cost to do the same thing today? We had World War II today. Well, a simple calculation that you can use from the Bureau of Labor Statistics on the computer is a consumer price index. You divide the current consumer price index by the historical consumer price index, and that gives you an index of what the dollar has done, either increased in value or decreased in value. And then you take that figure and multiply it by the number of killed, and you've got a different figure altogether. This CPI is a measure of the average change over time in the prices paid by urban consumers for a fixed market basket of consumer goods and services. It's a complicated analytical tool. The economic consumption analysis is regularly produced by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and serves as a general indicator of inflation in the American economy. The CPI is often referred to as the cost of living index, how much something goes up in price and what we have to pay for it now compared to a previous period. Now, if you take this 1942 figure of $50,000 per troop, that differential, and you use the CPI for 2003, which is 550.9. That's just a figure. And then you divide that by the 1942 CPI, which is 48.8. It comes out that the difference is $11.29. So what cost a dollar in 1942 cost $11.29 today. So you multiply those casualties, and a $50,000 casualty ends up costing in real dollars $564,500. Over $500,000. That's what it cost. And it really does cost that because the debt that we pay on war lasts over several generations. Inflation catches up with it, and you're paying for previous expenditures in current dollars. Okay? We do the same thing for Vietnam. But if you use that $50,000 figure for Vietnam, the cost of killing somebody in Vietnam brought the cost up to $96,500, almost twice as much. So in 20 years, 45 to 65, the cost of killing somebody in the kind of warfare that we were prosecuting, doubled. Now, if you go to the first Gulf War, funnier things start to happen. The price jumps up to $423,000, less than it was for today, but that was 1991. We've had 10 years, 12 years of inflation to play around. Inflation increases about 30% a decade as a rough rule of thumb in normal economic times. One conclusion that can be inferred from this simple math exercise is that killing an enemy in Modern high-intensity warfare is not really cost-effective and can have severe long-term social, political, and economic consequences for both the victor as well as the vanquished. This fact is not given serious consideration at the outbreak of a war, since national attention is focused on engaging the enemy, winning the war, defeating the enemy with the lowest cost in lives and blood, whatever the economic cost might be.